The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. This week's podcast is a recording of Mike Watson's talk with Mark McGowan, also known as the Artist Taxi Driver, at the Open School East. Mike Watson is an art theorist and curator based in Italy, and he writes regularly for Frieze, Art Review, and Radical Philosophy. His book, Towards a Conceptual Militancy, is currently out from Zero Books. It's Wednesday, June 15th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that Zero Books will be rolling out a membership site towards the end of this month. Members will get access to members-only podcasts, online workshops with our authors, and to some audiobooks. To find out more, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or check out Zero Books' blog at zerobooks.net. Also, Zero Book authors will be reading in libraries this summer in an effort to promote summer reading as a time for thinking, as well as for thrillers, celebrity gossip, and beaches. And if you enjoy Zero, you might recommend us to your local library and your local librarian. Let them know about our website, our monthly newsletter announcing new titles, and urge them to include our books in their collection. The music in this episode includes what you're listening to right now, which is the Swingles performing Bach's Fugue No. 5 in D major, as well as Crosley Bendix at Jamcom 84. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Mike Watson on conceptual militancy.
It's really great to have like so many people show up, and it's been a really busy series of events at Open School East. So I'm just going to give it to these guys.
Hey, thanks. Alright, my name's Mark McGowan. I'm the artist taxi driver. I won't be the artist taxi driver today. I'm here to with Mike Watson, who's written this book. We're going to talk about it. It's called Towards a Conceptual Militancy. Mike Watson, he lives in Rome, in Italy. He's a writer and contributor to these glossy art magazines, Frieze, Art Monthly, and Art Review. So it's a nice bottle of Hugo Boss or something. So he's written this book. I've been through it. I made notes, turned over the pages, like we used to do it. So I'm going to ask Mike some questions, and then after a little, we'll do about half an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour, try and draw out some of what's in the book, and then we'll open it up and we'll have a debate about it. Because it's quite interesting, isn't it? What's he talking about? Because it seems like quite radical, like he wants to do something. But when I was reading it, and when I was just thinking now, I'd start to think to myself, how's this going to go? Because we could end up being really pessimistic, you know, and thinking, you know, we just... Or it could be really optimistic. So as I was reading it, and I was just going through, thinking about the questions, I noticed, I was thinking, oh... Anyway, a conceptual militancy. What's that then, Mike?
I'll just explain a bit of the background of the book, but basically it's a book very broadly on the link between art and politics. So basically, you know, art and politics has become, I guess, very important since the economic crisis. So it's been a long time that we've been thinking about, through philosophy in the art world, about the potential of a political art. But it's become particularly particularly important in recent years, when I guess activism itself, the kind of the left, okay, the left wing has kind of failed us, I think, since the economic crisis. So there was like a perfect period, a perfect moment to resist capital, to kind of to bring forward alternatives. And particularly around 2010, when we were in Britain, when you were, I was in Rome at that point, protesting against the rising tuition fees, the left kind of returned to a kind of pre-1990 mentality. So we'd had this kind of statist communism, this idea of a state-backed left for many years, and then it kind of failed majestically in the early 90s, and we moved to something else. We moved to a kind of a third way politics, to Blairism, and then that failed with the economic crisis. And instead of saying, instead of like maybe proposing a new, different alternative, we went back to a statist politics. So basically, the kind of the dialogue during the protest against the education, the rising in education fees, was that we should go back to kind of full state backing of education. So rather than kind of using their imagination and proposing maybe something that was neither statist or corporate, we missed the opportunity. So I think we should have gone down more of an anarchist route at that point, but it wasn't proposed. So I was kind of watching this from Italy, and I was studying a PhD, talking around Adorno, Duchamp, Boyce, etc. And I kind of decided that we needed to kind of move outside the traditional binary between left and right and propose another way of thinking. Okay, so I approached it through art and was very influenced by a number of movements in Italy. Okay, so basically in Italy, five, six years ago, a number of spaces were occupied as kind of art occupations, and they proposed a kind of leftist politics, but not the traditional one. Okay, so basically through the book, it talks about how we can maybe apply these what we call bene comune or commons movements more broadly within the art world, but also it talks about how a kind of political art is kind of ineffective in many ways. That there's a bit like art in general, in a sense that art is about illusions. So if you think about something like Van Gogh's sunflowers, it's obviously not really sunflowers, okay? It's a painting of sunflowers. But the risk of a political art is similarly, when we make art as politics, we're not really making politics, we're making representations of politics. Yet the kind of political art maker, the political curator, wears the kind of badge of politics proudly, like they're doing something combustible or revolutionary. So I think, you know, we have to address this. Are we kind of playing around when we should be acting? This moment when we should be acting against this kind of advance of finance capital, we kind of migrated to the art world. Activism has migrated a lot to the art world, and we're fiddling around. So basically the book tries to address how we could possibly use art and do something kind of concrete with it. Okay, so the kind of final proposal is that we use art spaces to deliver alternative education systems, alternative education, alternative welfare, so we can grow up like a new welfare to replace the state model. So that's basically, so conceptual militancy is basically a kind of highly politicised conceptual art. So the idea is that we radicalise political art.
Okay, so we're talking, so the main thing is when you said about the left, we're addressing artists.
What sense? You mean through the
what you're trying to, who are you talking to? Who's your audience? Is it the artist?
Well,
or?
I suppose the point of the book is to both critique the left and the art world. So we kind of play art against leftist politics, and we play leftist politics against art. So the idea somehow is that by doing this, there's quite heavy critique in the second chapter of the left first. We can find a middle. So maybe like art has something that politics lacks, and vice versa. So art, through art, you can kind of imagine new realities, and you don't really actually have to kind of implement them. So you have this advantage. In art, we can say anything. In politics, you can act, you can do stuff, okay, but you can't really dream. The paths are generally blocked. So we need to somehow take the aspect of art where you can dream and apply it to politics. This has been like a centuries-long kind of struggle to try and do this, and it's not really possible. So I guess the book is about this inherent contradiction.
So as an artist involved in sort of like political art, there is this other group that's in the middle between the politics and the artists, and these are the activists. So that's a difference, isn't it? Because my experience of activists, like this is people who are trying or have a position that they're, whether it's through housing or whether it's through education, my experience is that they hate fucking artists. Do you know what I mean? They don't like the idea of art. They're not, you know, they were always, I remember indie media, which was around in the like 2000s, they didn't like artists because they always saw artists as being, like what you were saying, are you just pretending? Do you know what I mean? It's art, because if you start to say you're making it, oh, it's art, that takes away something from the activist who it's real. You know, if you're squatting or you're fighting against sort of like the criminalisation of squatting and things like that, no, that's a real proper struggle. You need a roof over your head.
Art is seen as somehow perhaps useless by activists and maybe bourgeois and kind of frivolous. But, you know, you could say that activism is also quite useless. So I don't really think it's an argument in itself. That, you know, an activist could say an artist is achieving nothing, but it's hard to see a real instance where activism has achieved a long-term kind of objective. So people could say, like, people could easily, like, then say the miners' strikes, the poll tax riots, the Arab Spring, but all those things have been reversed. There isn't actually, historically, in my mind, a case of somebody overturning the tendency of domination or the domination of the masses by the few in any lasting sense. So we tend to overturn it for a short period of time, but then there's a backlash. So if we think of the history of modernism, of leftist kind of actions since the French Revolution, there have been a series of kind of revolutions which have overturned the ruling class, but the tendency for fewer and fewer people to dominate more and more people has risen exponentially the whole time. So each generation, there is this kind of conflict between left and right, between workers and policemen workers, but they tend to kind of create a blockage of energy. Okay, and whilst they're blocked and embroiled in this fight, the people in power kind of carry on doing their thing. Okay, so in a way an activist could say art's useless, but art literally is useless. That is the point of art. Whereas activism, you know, the activists want to say that they're somehow more useful, more incisive, but they're not. I mean, so what I'm saying is that in a sense, you know, we're living in a very blocked political situation where it's very hard to find a way out of the kind of finance capital state we live in, particularly in Britain. And, you know, if we can't find a way out, we're going to have to pretend we can and then act from there. So in a way, you know, by talking about politics through art, we can pretend somehow and open up a space.
This is the pessimistic, optimistic thing that I started off with. If you do use this concept of think local, go global, where smaller groups win battles, like the Lewisham A&E, they fought for that and they won it. Or the E15 mums who fought for their housing and they won it. And then now are making a difference. They've got their own front and they've got their own little shop and they're supporting other people in housing. But if you look at the E15 mums, they're the new artists. Have you seen their banners? All their colourful banners. Stop social cleansing and all this sort of like brilliant typography. You know, it's fantastic. You know, and this is the reason why, because Mike was talking about the communes in Italy and what he talked about in there, why the government and why they wanted to stop things like Occupy and when they was at St. Paul's. Because the criminalisation of squatting and stopping that is people do need a roof over their head, but they politicise. They're in groups, and that's the problem with the students because they're only together for a couple of years and then they graduate and then a new batch comes in, so there's never that, you know, consistency. But the problem with organised movements like Occupy, where they had a library on the street, where they had a university on the street, where they were feeding the homeless. When I went there, you couldn't believe it. There was food, there was grapes, and it was like the best thing I've ever seen in my life. We're full of food on the streets. But what they do is they start educating, you know, they start reading the pedagogy of the oppressed. They start trying to work out how we can, like, shared education. They start to politicise and they start to make art. You know, and that's why they want to shut that down.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I think there are instances within activism where you see this kind of people trying to imagine something outside reality. We are very blocked, but once you kind of pretend something's possible or you imagine it, then it becomes possible. But I guess my argument is that it's kind of an artistic way of thinking. The practice of saying something's possible when it's not is artistic, because art, in a sense, is the kind of discipline where we're allowed to invent things without losing our credibility. Whereas in politics, religion, science, when you say something, you have to kind of mean it. So it's not so much that it can't happen through activism, but when it does, it is still using this kind of creative thought process.
So when you say art is always a deception, you said to me when we was outside and we were talking about pretending to be free.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about that?
There's basically, towards the end of the book, there's a kind of simple formula, and basically it says that we have this kind of risk that if we think we're free, generally we have this risk that if we think we're free, we may have been duped into thinking we're free. So basically, we can't really just comfortably imagine that we have this agency or possibility of acting. So we have to imagine that maybe we're not free. So always a kind of safest option from a point of view of democracy, okay, or maybe it's not the best word, but of kind of freedom of movement, freedom of thinking even, is to actually presume we're not free and then fight for it, okay? So, you know, we have to presume we're not free, but then we're in any case kind of screwed, because if you're not free, by definition, you still don't have the kind of, you know, you don't have the potential to then move and become free, okay? So either we say we're free, but then there's a risk we've been brainwashed. We say we're not free, but then we can't then be free. So the safest option then becomes to say, okay, we're not free, but let's pretend we are. Okay, so we're not free politically, okay, but as a kind of phenomenon, we know that as thinking beings, we can invent stuff. So, and that's a kind of process of art. So basically, what I'm saying is that, you know, the only kind of recourse we have is to kind of invent a freedom, and that in itself is in itself useless, but perhaps by keeping doing that, we can somehow open up some real potential.
I mean, it, just looking at the political spectrum right now in this country, we've got this morning we had Farage and Cameron on Mar, and we had Ruth Davidson and Suzanne Evans from UKIP. So you've got this wall-to-wall Tories with the Brexit, with the whole sort of like referendum, do we hate foreigners, yes or no? And all this, on top of all this, we have the austerity program. We have sort of like, you have like the rise of Donald Trump. You've got, other sort of like Islamic extremism, you know, pouring out all over the world. You know, we have got like massive rising conservatism, almost so much that the left right now doesn't even have a voice. No, he isn't even considered in political debate.
For sure, yeah, but I think that's partly a problem with the left and the way it responded in recent years to the crisis, and there was every potential to reinvent themselves and to propose a non-statist option. Because what we have basically now is we have a state, a nation-state, that doesn't want to provide any of the kind of good stuff they used to provide, like a free education, healthcare, welfare, etc., which is trying to basically lose those responsibilities, but still has the capacity to defend the rich. So we have a state that's only really there to defend economic interests. And given that, you'd think the left could say, okay, if we're going to basically, we're whittling down the state, we're basically removing the state in all but its kind of military policing capacity, then why don't we propose a non-statist option as well? If there's going to be no effective state, perhaps the left needs to kind of move into that area. So I think, there isn't really a viable left anymore, but there is that potential. And basically, until the early 1900s, the left was massively anarchist. It had a large anarchist element. First, in the late 1800s, Karl Marx kicked out Bakunin from the Communist International. We know that. Mikhail Bakunin, the anarchist. Yeah. He was a major figure in the Communist International. I think it was 1871 that there was a conference, a Communist International conference, and Marx basically said, like, I think we need a leader. And then he kind of said, well, and it happens, I think it should be me. So Marx took over the Communist International and kicked out Bakunin, kicked out the anarchist element, and then moved to making the left, making communism anarchist. But it hadn't always been. And then even in the early 1900s, Labour still had discussions over whether they should follow a statist or an anarchist model. So I think, yeah, that might be the way the left could move forward, is by proposing models that didn't rely on the state.
I mean, I see like global politics. I see a massive opportunity, you know, with the rise in the riot, you know, with the taking over things like housing, you know, the housing bill, you know, the housing association right to buy. You know, right now it's a massive potential for cooperatives that we saw in the 60s and 70s, massive cooperatives, you know, to come in and say, right, we're going to take over housing, we're going to create our own housing.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's been seen in Italy in the last few years, in occupations like Teatro Valle. Teatro Valle is basically the ballet theatre, is the oldest theatre in Rome. And it became empty in 2011. And basically what happened is that activists, particularly activists involved in theatre, they really feared that it would be sold off to private interests. So, right, around that time, there was a referendum on water ownership in Italy. And the question put nationally was whether it should be privately owned or bene comune, which means literally commons. Okay, whether it should be privately owned or effectively owned by everyone and no one. Okay, so this idea of the commons, we also have in British history. And the referendum, they won 97% to make water a commons. So what happened that day is various activists, theatre worker activists in Rome, occupied this ballet theatre and they declared it a bene comune, a commons. So they had this idea that we can now provide culture as a common good. And they ran a very good, strong programme for 3 years until they were basically asked to leave. And the point is that in this period, they declared this as a commons, as I said, but this was based on Article 43 of the Italian Constitution. The Italian Constitution actually provides for the commons because it was written just after World War II, and to kind of form an alliance, a new government in Italy, they had to include anarchists in the parliament, Christian Democrats, etc. So it's a very broad constitution. But the point is that these kind of artist workers in the theatre who occupied it were working around legality. They were working around the constitution. So they basically made a kind of anarchist entity via a legal entity, which I found very interesting, because it was like, in a way, the artists were appropriating state and legal mechanisms. So, you know, in a sense, that made me think that the state, the government, you know, these things are all very much like art. A nation state basically is a declaration. Somebody says, like, I'm going to make a nation state. Okay, there's always some kind of formal declaration. Then they have an army to back them up, etc., etc. But fundamentally, it's a declaration. It's a poetic type statement. And a lot of constitutions are very poetical, very poetic if you read them. So what they're doing with the Queen now, the Queen's celebrations, all these kind of symbols, the flag. But you know, you sing like the Trooping of the Colour the other day. They're all symbols. So in a sense, power, the powerful are doing what artists are doing. And if an artist can mimic that, can engage with that, in a way we expose the fallacy of power. We expose that, you know, this is actually an actual fact. By making art, by copying, you know, flags, whatever, legal processes, constitutions, by appropriating them, you're showing that that's all they're doing. It's only a declaration backed up by an army. So part of the book is based on this experience in Italy and how, you know, there's a great similarity between art and legislation and state building.
So an artist can mimic the legal processes.
Yeah, it's one of the kind of...
But this idea of occupation, because recently the library down in Brixton, the Carnegie Library, they wanted to turn it into like a gym and without librarians, and they just went in and occupied it. The the local people done that, and they went and they got the bailiffs and they took them out, like physically took them out and put them out the door, you know, within a couple of weeks, maybe a month at the most. And then now they've got security guards, and the security guards cost more than it would cost to open that library for a year. You know, they would rather pay more and get you out. You know, that's the same thing as what we were talking about. You know, in the when we talk about our struggles, and you look at the you know, the Arab Spring, what happened in Egypt and what happened in Syria is like they will go to fucking war. You know, their idea of like you want to come and take the power. We would rather live in an Armageddon than cede 1 inch of territory to anyone. And even in Egypt, they let them have the power for a little bit and then came back again and took it back off them. You know, the struggle is... So, I mean, my question, like, even if you think... This seems really sort of like... as artists living in here, because part of the book talks about the 99% and the nuance in the 99%. Like, who makes our pants? You know, because there's people like out in the world that live in very small countries, and
yeah, there's a critique of activism. Basically, at a certain point early in the book, I talk about how we need to be basically more honest. So part of this idea of what's called, because it's kind of sensational sounding, what's called conceptual militancy in the book, is that we need to kind of think more deeply. So somehow in the political world, we don't really get time to think deeply, but in the art realm, we can kind of step back maybe and think a bit more about what we're doing and about the kind of statements we're making and about how, you know, we're being often quite hypocritical. So if you take the anti-war movement as one example, you know, we tend to say we're anti-war, but in a sense, you know, we're feeding into the war machine. When we pay taxes, when we pay VAT, you know, we're paying basically for these wars, and we're not doing, you know, we may well be anti-war, sure, we're all anti-war, we're not really, because it's like, if they were our children, our family dying, we often say things like, you know, it feels a bit like it's our own family, blah, blah, but it doesn't, because if they were our own family, we'd be fighting a lot harder, and we're actually just sitting here, you know, we're not really fighting this situation. And it's the same with capitalism. The 99%, this idea that, you know, we are part of the 99%, but it hides a kind of basic culpability, because there are many different kind of stratospheres of this 99%. There's a, you know, what the top of the 99% is going to be way richer than the bottom of the 99%. So I think that's something that gets us off the hook. So we need to, we need to rethink everything. Basically, that was the point. You came out with a good quote from here, radical atheism.
Yeah. I mean, having that position where you don't believe in anything or you question everything, but it's also, it's really sad, you know, like when you start to like really sort of conceptualize everything, like or start to take apart like the world and what's actually happening and our part in it. It's really quite sad, isn't it? Because I get really sort of like desperate about, you know, I rant every day in the car. It can be about like, you know, When you see the fighting in the football yesterday, the hooligans like going off and kicking off, like really pummeling people's head into the ground, and you think this is like real, you know, this is a consequence of right wing politics. You know, it's no coincidence. I mean, the last major thing was back when the Tories was in power back in, you know, this is real, you know, this is how people react. You know, Frankie Boyle said to me, you know, racism comes from the top down. You know, people are fed it. And it's not new. You know, it's not new trying to, like, you know, disguise the whole thing around, like, pointing fingers. You know, this whole Brexit thing. You know, this is a massive proportion of the population captured in a political debate right now. We're not involved in it. You know, if we are, it's like we're on the fringes of it. And there's millions of people involved in it. There's millions of people who are really sort of like, you know, it's the wrong way, it's the wrong time. You know what? It's 2016. I can't even believe it. I cannot believe where we're at the moment. You know, thinking about like artists making an impact on that, it's just like ludicrous. You know what I mean? Artists like around fucking East London making their sort of like, kind of like, I don't know, making their little works or like doing whatever we do. You know, it's a joke, really, isn't it? And art is on its ass. It has no political movement at the moment. It's completely on its ass. That's my quote at the back. You know, there it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's we was watching Terence McKenna before. You know, culture is not your friend. You know, culture is captured by the rich and the powerful. You know, it's the hedge funders that buy all the fucking massive paintings and the objects and everything. Who owns the art?
Yeah, it's massively complicit with finance, yeah. But also we're in the period, the kind of most politicised period of art history since probably the 70s. And it's the biggest the art world has been. We never had more artists, more biennales, more museums, foundations, galleries, magazines. And you know, there's a lot of this space is dedicated to politics, like the last biennale, the Venice Biennale last year, I think it was, yeah. Which was based around Das Kapital. So you had the curator, Okwe Emwuzor, and he, you know, basically had to make a theme, and he made this theme which said, you know, let's use the Biennale to rethink the role of capital in the light of Marx's Das Kapital. So they had like a daily reading of Das Kapital during the Biennale, but it was just so, it was like a nail in the coffin of the left, and the nail was driven in through art, which was even worse in a way. And this, you know, this whole thing of reading Das Kapital, I mean, most people who go to the Biennale are quite wealthy because you have to pay to get to Venice, to stay in Venice. You have to pay €30 to get in. And then you're not going to really reflect on Das Kapital by watching somebody perform, reading Das Kapital. You know what I mean?
It's also the class that people consume in it, though, isn't it? It's almost
like the worst way to reflect on Das Kapital. So we have these statements in the art world which are kind of like whitewashing. You can say through art, you know, you can say, you know, we're doing something political, and immediately kind of exonerates these people from complicity with it within the capital system, but in a sense then they're more complicit. It's a way of kind of getting money.
Yeah, and then you look at like the class of it all and like who's involved, and like even when, you know, when there was a really big chance when Scotland nearly got its independence, which would have changed everything. We wouldn't be where we are now if Scotland had got its independence, trust me. The whole fucking country would have been completely different. You know, it was a time, it was a real big moment. You know, we had Syriza going on, we had Podemos in Spain going on, and we had Scotland. It was radical. It was a new fucking politics. And who fucked it up? The Guardian-reading fucking liberals who were too scared of losing their mortgages because they're all mortgaged up. Do you know what I mean? Because they don't want to lose their homes because they were scared into it. Do you know what I mean? But the people, that were the working class people, they were ready for it. And it would have destroyed the Conservative Party, it would have destroyed the Union, it would have been fucking over, do you know what I mean? And everything would have been different. We would have been on a wave of radicalised politics and new politics.
I think you're right, yeah. Also because of the rhetoric on TV, you know, I come back to England like every year, every 6 months. Every time I come back, the rhetoric is just way more right-wing, way more monarchist. And then I just happened to come back now during the birthday weekend of the Queen, so obviously it's really been pushed to extremes, but there's a lot of talk about Britain in TV adverts and the news, Britain. And, you know, we've gone back to that when we nearly divided Britain. It didn't happen, so it kind of gave a mandate for the powerful to re-emphasise this idea of Britain, which is imperialist in itself. But
yeah, but that's a time, a moment, when you had a massive, you know, they were really doing well up in Scotland, and you had lots of really good sort of, like, community groups, activists. You know, everyone was against them. And now they've just handed it to the right, do you know what I mean? So now it's all back to them.
Every time, I mean, just, you know, not to be over-negative, but it is deeply negative, but everything is overturned. The Arab Spring, how did that go? Mm. The Arab Spring became the Syrian conflict. You know, all these things are being overturned quite sharply. So that makes you think, you know, what is the right road?
Well, a Brexit suits them, do you know what I mean? I don't give a fuck, they love a Brexit. You know, all the Tories, all the right wing, the nationalists, you know, the imperialists, they'll love it. You know, but I mean, coming back to this sort of like pessimistic, optimistic thing, I think, like, I'm thinking along the lines that think local, go global, that we can organise in small groups, you know, and that we can make a difference. And if someone wins something somewhere, then the people know. If they change the law, like what they tried to do down Lewisham at the A&E, like Jeremy Hunt changed the law, tried to get in some other people, tried to get them to come in to say, right, it's going to be shut down. They fought for it and they won it, and it stopped. a whole raft of like closures in A&Es across the country. So they knew that they would be challenged. The same thing's happened with fracking. The only people that's going to stick up for fracking are the people who live around there. I went down to Balcombe, you know, Balcombe when it was, I went down to the camp. Was anyone down there? I see a truck come down a country road. It was like one of those things you see at the carnival in Brazil. It's as big as this room. I was thinking, oh my Jesus, look at the size of that. It was just trundling down the road because they're going to start doing the fracking. Now that place, you know, Balcombe, it's 100% solar. The whole place has gone solar because all the residents, it was the local residents that joined with the activists. It was the activists that spurred them on. But they've changed that. And now you've got little groups all up in Lancashire. You've got, they're everywhere. I've got loads of contacts in the fracking community. They've got their fucking tents ready. They're going. Do you know what I mean? They will go wherever to support local people and to tell local people, this is going to be a disaster for your community. You know, fighting back against sort of like the power that want to control the means of production. You know, there is, I mean, that's the optimism. That's what I was thinking in this book, because at the end you do talk about little groups, don't you?
Yeah, I talk about how one forms a group. I talk a bit about objectification, about the idea that we're somehow objectified or kind of made objects. So in two ways, really, via science and then via the economic system. So I'm not anti-science, but in a way, you know, being educated in science these days on a very basic level, even at school, we basically know that we're objects. So you know, we are objects, we're material beings, unless you're deeply religious. But then also through the economic machine, through work, we're also kind of objectified because we, you know, we have a monetary value, we become money. And then how do you escape that? How do you become a subject? So I talk a bit about Duchamp and how Duchamp declares things as art. So you can say, like, this chewing gum is art, or anything is art, as we know. And you know, that's the kind of tool we can use. So if you can say things of things that they're not, which is what art's about, maybe we can declare ourselves as subjects when really we're objects. We, you know, we need to do it ourselves.
Is that somehow the whole coup of the book?
That is the basic thing. That is kind of the conceptual element, is that using Duchamp's anything can be art, with Duchamp's, with Boyce's, the statement, no, we are all artists. You know, Boyce said this thing, yeah, Anyone's an artist. So if you put the two together, you're kind of obligated then to behave politically, to use this thing politically. So, you know, the idea is that we declare ourselves as free somehow, and then we can make a meaningful group. Because unless you're free individually, you can't be a meaningful community. You'll just be a community of object actors banging against each other. So, yeah, that's basically the premise, I guess.
I mean, I went down to Runnymede, where they built loads of homes and they're all living in woods. Went up to Sweetsway, where they built a community, where they were knocking down. You know, people are coming together and forming those, like, sort of like little, you know, this Teepee Valley down in Wales. They're kind of popping up everywhere. But as artists, like, if we're addressing artists, and how can art be this? How can art make a difference? How can art make this intervention into politics instead of, like, into capital, where it's sort of like just making objects to be sold? You know, we were talking before, and I mentioned Peggy Phelan, who said the power of performance lies in it not really being there. The power of performance lies in it not really being there. And I think that's what I got from this book, is like the conceptual. You know, we need ideas. You know, if you have an idea as a radical tool, and as that, artists can mimic legal processes. You know, if you have an idea and frame it around this idea of art, or give it out into the world, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, if it can be done. I think that, you know, the point is the book tries to look at what really can be done, or how we might make art political. So it kind of goes through a number of theoretical kind of somersaults to get there. But what it's really saying is that if we're going to attend, you know, we're going to like be saying all this stuff about art and politics on a massive international scale, then, you know, we need to either make it useful or give it up. So basically this is like, it's really, the thing is the book started, I started writing it, actually, it's quite a slim book, but I started writing it 6 years ago, and it's been that long that I've been thinking, because when I started writing it, kind of, the combination of art and politics wasn't such a big deal, but it's become a bigger and bigger deal in those years since the crisis. And, you know, so as I was writing it, I thought, like, people don't really need to know you know, what art and politics is, or go over debates from Adorno, Kant, Frankfurt School, etc., go over the philosophical debates that you learn on an MA or whatever, that we need to kind of address, you know, what we're doing with this, and either make it concretely valuable or discard it, because it's kind of embarrassing otherwise. You know, we keep talking about art and politics, but don't do politics, then, you know, we're kind of charlatans. But then it comes to a point, something I wanted to say is that, you know, most political artists I know who are serious, who are like working daily, and who are really kind of committed, like I guess you, Tanya Bruguera, Oliver Ressler, talking to Mark, they tend to be aware of these kind of inherent contradictions. They tend to be aware that the whole thing's not really working. So if you actually talk to a serious political artist, they'll say to you that it's not working. So we're at a kind of crucial point when we... Yeah.
But I think one of the things I find about my practice is most people I engage with, I've got no idea that it's art. Most people say, oh, you're really a taxi driver. No one ever says you're really an artist. So they take it on face value. So it's proper mimicking. It's a real intervention into... But that was a really good thing. Make it useful or give it up. That's a good work ethic to have, isn't it? Make it useful or give it up.
Yeah, but that's really, I think, the feeling from some people. But I'm often in the position, because I work as a critic and also a creator, of working with political artists and putting that kind of statement to them. But I'm working with it. I'm also working with it as a theorist. But I'm really feeling like there's something problematic here. And, you know, that is a thing. Either it needs to stop being problematic, or we can just go back to painting,
yeah,
or we can go back to aesthetics, or we can just go into activism. But the thing is, activism's not working either. So it's, you know...
What I always say to the students, or if I'm talking to someone, or, you know, talking about their work and that, I always say, like, as a starting point, as artists, as a starting point, we should be looking at, like, because lots of people material-led, you know, like, oh, I've got, you know, plaster or paint or, you know, or their theme-led, I'm going to be in a show about, you know, whatever. But your starting point as an artist should be, I'm going to make something absolutely extraordinary. I'm going to make something that when people see it, they're going to get knocked out. They're going to be, oh, my fucking God. They're going to be telling people about it. They want it. That should be a starting point. No, it doesn't have to be anything outrageous. You know what I mean? It can just, you know, some of the most extraordinary things are the smallest things. And some of the most extraordinary things, you know, but that should be the starting point for artists. You know, I'm going to make something absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, make something, or if it's a political artist, at least I'm going to do something extraordinary. But I'm going to do something effective that's going to change something.
And your thing about, like, saying make something, make it useful, give it up, or the conceptual thing that, you know, we have to... You can say anything. Do you realise that? You can say absolutely anything. It just has to be said. It just has to be the idea. We could sit down now and do a thing where we all write down, you've got no money, what you can have as much money as you want, there's no bounds to what you can make. It can be as big as you like, it can be. Can you imagine that you had that opportunity to, like, it could be anything? But you know, sometimes it's just in words. And the words are describing what you would make. But to other people, it would be real. So, like, when I do an event, like when I was, like, eating a small corgi dog, for instance, like, I sent out a press release, I'm going to eat a small corgi dog in a protest against Prince Philip. It was in the newspapers, and people will read that. Now, even before the event happens, they will understand that and read it, because it has all the signs and signifier. It said, artist eats a small corgi dog. You know, artist is good. You know, it's massive. Because you frame those words, you've used those. It's fucking Derrida, isn't it? It's Nietzsche, truth and lies. You know, using language. You know, it's all linguistics. It's all about using words. That's the conceptual bit, isn't it? You know, it's Claes Oldenburg, who made those big, massive things. Go and find this book, his Unrealized Projects. Oh, my fucking God. Do you know what I mean? It's just text. There's not even drawings. There's one or two drawings, but it's describing these most incredible things. I was telling you before, I wanted to build like a bronze, like the size of Statue of Liberty of John F. Kennedy. Do you know what I mean? How are you even going to be? How would you even like cast that? You know, and then he wanted to invert it into the ground in Central Park. He was going to cut a hole like in the bottom of his shoe, and then visitors would come and they could look down it like that. So he was just making it up, but it was a project to him, and you believed it because of the things that he'd already built. He put a tap at the top of a big mountain, didn't he? And giant, he used to make giant things.
And now, Crosley Bendix, cultural reviewer and director of Stylistic Premonitions for the Universal Media Network, with today's Arts Review.
Signs so big they're never out of view. Sounds surround. Box talk, box talk. 100,000 characters on newsprint. Tears fall silently in a dark theater. These are a few lines from the forthcoming album by Negative Land, but they suggest much more than that. As awareness of how the media environment we occupy affects and directs our inner life grows, some resist. The possibility of adding pimples to the retouched photo of the face on the cover of America are only now being seen as artistic territory. The cultural jammer works his secret in public. The skillfully reworked billboard with new lettering painted in the same style that the original has, turning strategic corporate elements back on themselves in a manner which is itself invisible, directs the public viewer to a consideration of the original corporate strategy in the context of a thoughtful reaction. The studio for the cultural jammer is the world at large. His tools are paid for by others. An art with real risk. You people still painting out there, all you crazy stone cutters, would you go to jail for your art? Well, the punishment for jammer art will probably more often take the form of fines and lawsuits. So, an anonymous art. A piece is not finished until the artist doesn't get identified. The arena, however, guarantees personal satisfaction for the artist, unlike the small, closed circle of fine art theorists at which traditional art forms aim themselves. So, keep your ears up and your eyes open. A jammer could appear on your TV, or a radio show like this one, or in your favorite newspaper or fan magazine, even in your art gallery. You can spot jam art easily. It always supersedes found content as it rearranges it, causing you to reflect on the nature of what you're actually encountering. Good morning.
Listening to cultural reviewer and social critic Crosley Bendix.